Hi, this is Joel Plaskett, and I listen to the number one station in Kingston, CFRC.
I'm here backstage, or, well, outside the Room Factory, and I've got two members of Busty and the Bass. Guys, hello. Thanks so much for talking to me today.
How are you?
I'm very excited for this show. I mean, we were just talking about, you know, the fact that you guys kind of came out of McGill and a kind of university music scene. Kingston also very much of a, like, campus town, you know, I guess similar vibes and all that stuff. And you guys have been to Kingston before, right? Like, you're comfortable here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is the first place we actually came outside of Montreal to come play.
That seems to be a pretty common thing for a lot of bands. Like, a couple of others, Arkells came here a little while ago, and they were like, this was the first non-Guelph town we played.
Yeah, it's the same thing for us. Yeah, coming down from Montreal is easy. A couple of us at the time were from Toronto as well, so it made a lot of sense, a bit of a stepping stone to come home. Yeah, it was really always really fun coming down here, and a lot of us had a lot of friends from Toronto, the GTA, which really helped us kind of get off the ground and get a party started here, and that was half the battle, and then from there it kind of took off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I heard that when you guys started, like, because you were music students, there was like an academic aspect to the music, but being in Busty and the Bass was sort of your way of, you know, music parties in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's been a really, it's been a fun journey to kind of try and transcend a lot of that kind of music school stuff and distill it into something that's just like more fun and a bit of a party. You know, I think it has a bit of a connotation of being a bit cold or, you know, a bit uninspired. And so it's always kind of fun to find new ways to try and use that information and knowledge and apply it to social settings.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, when you have those many people up on stage as well, I feel like it feels like a party up there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course, yeah. It's, yeah, it's a lot different touring as a 6-7 piece. We started as a 9-person band. the party doesn't stop. Yeah, it's crazy.
But, I mean, you say that, but also you have put out a new EP just like 2 days ago, which I've been listening to. I've really been enjoying it. It's called The Mannequin. And I found it's a very rich, you know, complex sound, kind of layered. There's a lot of soulful elements, a lot of really beautiful, like, keys and stuff like that going on, too. It's kind of psychedelic. Some tracks are a bit more euphoric, but there's also a bit of, like, a dark undercurrent beneath them. So I'm hearing a lot going on in there. So first of all, just congratulations on the new EP. Can you tell me a bit about the sound?
Yeah, well, the sound, I think for us, is, especially with the inclusion of Jordan, I think this has been a really awesome kind of new chapter in our music. I think that, like, our last full-length album, Forever Never Cares, was our first real delve into kind of beginning to, I think for us, find our own voice in, within our kind of genre space and kind of step out in a way that was, you know, I think really different for our fans. But, you know, it was something we had really been working up to for a really long time in terms of trying to find ways of using our instruments that, you know, we felt like really spoke to us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this new record, especially with Jordan, like, we found our, it's the beginning of a chapter of finding a new way, like, another evolution of that sound, which is awesome, and, like, you know, kind of continuing to bend genre.
I almost feel like it's a bit more kind of like you're exploring so much more in the instrumentation space as well.
Absolutely.
And
yeah, I think when you add a person, especially like a new singer, it's just a matter of exploring and like figuring out what the new avenue is. And it's been really fun just doing that. And I think it's going to just yield a lot of different results.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, actually, because, like, I know you had a change of singer, and in a lot of band structures, the singer is sort of, like, the central focus of the band. Now, obviously, you guys were a lot more jazzy, a lot more kind of instrument-focused, but I think it changes the dynamic, right, when suddenly you're, you don't have, like, a fixed singer. I do hear vocals on, like, the EP and everything, but suddenly the dynamic changes, and I guess you focus on other things.
Yeah, it kind of feels like, I mean, like from when I joined the band or just before when I knew them, it always felt like everybody was really individually strong and just adding like their own flavor.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't quite feel to me from the outside looking in that like the singer had the whole band built around like his sound or anything. It always felt like a really big collaborative thing. And I think that'll like continue. I hope that continues.
Mm-hmm. And just talking about the live show, I think it's going to be my first time seeing you guys because I wasn't here the last time you guys played a show over here. But, you know, like we were talking about earlier, it's like this on-stage kind of party vibe from what I've seen from your videos as well. There's a lot of, like, there's a lot of fun happening on stage. What can people expect when they see you tonight?
Well, I think they can expect a really exciting show. I think that what we've, like, been doing and accomplishing live is a really captivating set. And it's very compelling. You know, we don't kind of, we tend to do a lot of different styles and genres. You know, our style and sauce, if you will, is definitely kind of what glues it together. And so, busting the bass show, it's cool. It's a real celebration of music and all different styles and tempos and feels. And, you know, and I think what we really enjoy is drawing lines between things that just, like, either didn't exist before, people wouldn't think of, you know, that, you know, the links between jazz and dancing and, you know, between soul and, like, hip-hop. Well, that's not good, but, you know, I think regardless of that, like, we tend to draw a lot of lines and do a lot of things that a lot of people don't. And I think we really enjoy getting to do that. Trying to bring something new to an audience and show them just, like, not only can exploring like that be, like, really different, but it can just be super fun and, like, you know, not anything you would have expected from that.
The dynamics, yeah. I feel like the show is just really dynamic. And, yeah, what he said.
Still, when you walk, say, I've been holding back. I've been known just to prop you up, sit you down, help you out. There's a crisis on your back. I've been known just to sit you down, prop you up, help you out. It's me.
Put these hands together just like that. Come on, baby. Come on, baby. Keep it clapping. Keep it clapping.
See, I've been holding back. I've been wrong just to prop you up, sit you down, help you out. There's a crisis on your back. I've been wrong just to sit you down, prop you up. See, I've been holding back. I've been known just to prop you up, sit you down, help you out. There's a crisis on your back. I've been known just to prop you up, sit you down, help you out. And listen.
Ladies and gentlemen, how are we feeling tonight? Woo. It's a Friday night in Kingston. We are busting the bass. It feels so good to be here tonight. This is the very first night of our Mannequin tour. We just had an EP yesterday called The Mannequin, which you will hear of. Thank you. Kingston was the very first place we played outside of Montreal, so it's good to be here full circle.
You were talking about like blending together these different styles of music and, you know, coming up with something that maybe people haven't heard before or they don't imagine it working well together. And I feel like I'm seeing a little bit of this coming up in the last few years around the world as well, like, you know, bands like Ezra Collective and people who have this really kind of this kind of neo-jazz style, as they're calling it. And it's really starting to like pick up in the world as well, where once people may have thought, oh, you know, hip-hop and jazz or soul and jazz are maybe very different or whatever, but it's coming together very naturally and people are really kind of getting behind it. So what do you guys make of that? I mean, it's working out at the exact same time perfectly for you.
It's absolutely amazing. I'm so, I have to say, like, I think for a long time music has been, you know, especially in the mainstream, like, it's a really interesting time for music. I think the industry is like a funny one to begin with, but mm-hmm. in a time of like social media, it's pretty wild. But what I can say is, like, I think the direction of music itself and creativity is something that's like really on the up in an amazing way. I'm seeing a lot of artists like really finding new sounds and blending stuff, and it's just really refreshing. I really feel like for the first time in a while, I can sense music kind of shifting in an artistic way that I'm really excited to see. It's a change that I've kind of, you know, I think it's a change that we've been trying to, you know, definitely not be at the forefront of, but just kind of try and do and embody, and like, you know, it's something that we've been seeing for ourselves. And so to be seeing it kind of happening around us with like, especially with a lot of our peers, is like really, really cool.
Who are you guys listening to nowadays?
That's a good question.
Yeah, I feel like I'm listening to so many different people, but I did want to say also, like, I feel like our age, just like, you know, being in our mid-30s, and I feel like that's playing a part in just like also evolving like musically and diving back into things that are like inspired us when we were younger, and just evolving. But yeah, I feel like these days there's also so much music kind of just like streaming and thrown at you that it's I'm just listening to like a lot of singles all the time. I do like Salt though.
Oh yeah.
The band.
Mm-hmm.
There's like a few bands who I feel like I would really like to be in that lane, and I feel like I try to like nudge for those mm-hmm. types of sounds. So like the Salt, the Cleo Soul. You know, I'm like there. I come from like a big R&B background from Philadelphia and the sort. So yeah, right. I'd say that's like my favorite band right now.
Jordan's got amazing music too. He's got like the most amazing like Spotify playlist he just keeps adding to.
Yeah.
That million songs long. It's so cool. Yeah.
And also just like coming back to the origins of the band, I mean, you guys also came together as a really genre-less band. I mean, at a time when people were still kind of like, this is rock music, this is jazz music, this is like for the pits. This is for whatever, like the Massey Hall or whatever
yeah,
it might be.
Totally, yeah. We really did. We've always kind of had this identity of being this, you know. Some call it eclectic, and I think in my mind, I see it more as variety, you know. And I think we've always kind of been like that. We always had that identity, and I think funny enough, like you know, it's cool to see like a lot of groups in this world, like you know, stuff using genre. And I think especially over time, us distilling our own sound and feel for what we've kind of been trying to do, and finding something more focused in that helps us feel like really realized within kind of the potential and like seeing the vision through of kind of what we've always been is this like kind of wild beast that's just up there being like, you know, untamably creative and having fun.
Well, and this wonderful new direction that you guys have gone in, I know the EP's just come out, but are you guys working on like an album or something further from there?
Absolutely. Lots in the works.
Mm-hmm.
Tons of new music. Stay tuned.
All right, folks, this is a brand new song.
Understand. Take the fast pace that
settle down. I would know you'd like it, I could be around. Tell me if you'd like it, throw me to the ground. I would know you'd like it, I could settle down. Tell me if you'd like it, I could settle down. I would know you'd like it, I could be around. Tell me if you'd like it, throw me to the ground. Tell me if you'd like it, I could settle down. Tell me if you'd like it.
Hey, Kingston, make some noise for Jordan Brown one more time.
Thank you. Woo.
This man's only been officially in the band for close to a year now.
Yeah.
Feels longer, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Feels like ages.
It's all family.
I was also going to ask one thing, because you're a really big band of people and you've been going for 10 plus years. Bands that are half your size don't last this long. And you also come from like very different musical tastes and influences. How do you keep a band this big together for so long?
That's a great question.
I think everybody really does a job in themselves to show up and to contribute. So mm-hmm. I think there's just a lot of glue. Some people are stickier than others, and I would really attribute most of it to that. And that's just me, you know, being around for the past couple of years and just seeing it. They really do, the band holds itself together.
Mm-hmm. I think that's actually a really valuable, you know, being so lost in the sauce, it's hard to know sometimes. I think that's a really cool way of putting it. Jeez. Until I think about that one.
It's a bit of a family, even just
absolutely family.
Yeah, so you know, it's, everyone still gets along.
You know, one thing that really comes to mind is humor. I think that like we're really a bunch of goofballs.
It's in your name.
Yeah, exactly. It is in our name, and like, you know, it's the truth that like we have a ball. You know, we're like it's a lot of having fun, joking around, and I think it's a huge part of the camaraderie and just like showing up. You know, that's really what makes it super special. Mm-hmm. Part of like the bonding and stuff.
Amazing. I mean, that's all I'm hoping to see tonight as well.
Yeah, yeah, it's a couple good moments for sure. Mm-hmm. The show.
Well, I can't wait to like see it, to see what you guys are up to next, all of that stuff. But thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you. I'm glad you're coming to the show.
We had the opportunity of playing with George Clinton from Parliament Funkadelic for this song. It's called Beg Ya Dope Man.
Facts on the page, and I'm spinning round again. Beg. Without the days, build it up, but just pretend. Baby, but it's all in your head. It's all in your head. Ask me about the bang, yeah, dope man. I can tell you this for free. Something about the baggy eyed dope man, he can take control of me. And I know in my soul it's sure. Ooh, it's a fragile thing. You're so weak, you feel like I'm crazy. Just you wait and see. Stream of consciousness when I'm in my phone. All up in your consciousness and I'm in your own. My boogie dope man, bring me a bone. I'm hooked and there's nothing to it now, but it's all. About the baggy eyed dope man, I can tell you this for free. Something about the baggy eyed dope man, he can take control of me. And I know in my soul it's showing. Ooh, it's a fragile thing. You're so weak,
crazy, just you wait and see.
This next song we got is called Dance With Someone. Let's go. We've been playing this for time too. If anyone was at the Ale House in 2018 or whatever, yeah, we got some people.
I just got something that you should know. I wanna dance with someone. Something inside makes me wanna show. I put my hands to someone, break that feeling loose and let it go. Shake it out to someone, and then we do it again, and then we do it again, and then we do it again. I just got something that you should know. I wanna dance with someone. Something inside makes me wanna show. I put my hands to someone, break that feeling loose and let it go. I shake it out to someone, and then we do it again.
You're rushing on the side of my thigh. I wanna know why. I wanna see if you can divide. I wanna see if you can do your time staples too. And I can take time to listen to you. Nobody, if you're feeling kinda down and lonely, I can see a found solace since you're holding for a trophy and you hold it so close. Focus, focus on your honeybee. Sometimes I wonder, I feel the heat of my thigh. I'ma need to run because I'ma need another love. I don't need the baby mama. I can feel the beat of wonder. I don't wanna feel the trauma and wait from all the drama. The beat's grooving, I can feel your feet moving. I don't need to bring it to you. I don't think you disapprove, do ya? Yeah, so come on and take a chance with me. Damn girl, I just want someone to dance with me.
Got something that you should know. I wanna dance with someone. Something inside makes me wanna show. I put my hands to someone, break that feeling loose and let it go. Shake it out to someone, and then we do it again, and we do it again, and we do it again.
On piano, Sledgehammer Hands.
got something that you should know. I wanna dance with someone, something inside makes me wanna show. I'll put my hands on someone, break that feeling loose and let it go. Shake it out for someone, and let me do it again, let me do it again, let me do it again. I just got something that you should know. I wanna dance with someone, something inside makes me wanna show. I'll put my hands on someone, break that feeling loose and let it go. Shake it out for someone, and then we do it again, and then we do it again, and we do it again.
Hey, this is Jordan from Bustin' the Bass, and you are listening to CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston.
Thank you so much. Man, Kingston, we gotta come back soon.
KPP Concerts and CFRC 101.9 FM present a stacked lineup of shows this January and February at the Broom Factory, featuring a mix of big-name acts and some local favorites. On January 18th, don't miss Canadian alt-rock duo, Mountain Head. January 24th features local indie rock outfit, Cassador. On January 26th, Bedouin Soundclash takes the stage. February 7th sees Busty and the Bass come to town. And on February 19th, it's a special Wednesday night rock show with headliners Dear Rouge. For additional information and to buy tickets, visit kppconcerts.com.
Today, from the Wings Archive.
How many times do we separate from each other because we don't want to do the work?
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
There's Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Bell Hooks died on December 15, 2021, at her home in Berea, Kentucky, at age 69. Many obituaries list her credentials, her influence, and her 30 or so books. People are posting favorite Bell Hooks quotes all over social media. Hooks is also justly famous for her blunt, clear, and loving lectures.
How many times do we separate from each other because we don't want to do the work of confronting? Because confronting may be bringing pain. How many times do white women and women of color say to me, well, you know, I just dropped out of this because I couldn't deal with those white women anymore. And yet, we will hang into relationships working with them. I said, how many of us have an intimate relationship where we never get angry? Where we never have impulses of rage? What we believe is that even in the midst of those impulses of anger or rage, it is our greater good, our collective feeling of care that will guide us. Why don't we feel the same thing in our movements? Why don't you feel the same thing at those meetings when you are locking heads with women of color and men of color over issues of difference? Around racism, around classism. Why don't bourgeois black women who are confronting working class women who say, you don't understand our issues, feel that same willingness to believe that the overall feeling of commitment and care can guide us through dissent, chaos, and crisis? Why do we allow those things to fall apart often? Why do we say, well, I won't try to do that anymore? You know, I had a young black bourgeois woman tell me I went somewhere to help these women, you know, and they were just so hostile. And I said, well, did you think about the way you framed it? Did you think about the location that you were coming from? And why with one attempt are you willing to give up? Do you give up that way in the relationships of intimacy in your life? Don't we struggle in the midst of patriarchy? Don't many of you who are heterosexual struggle with men daily, believing and hoping eternally that you can bring some greater good to the situation, and yet we don't bring that same eternal hope and conviction to our movement?
From the Wings Archive, bits of wisdom from the late Bell Hooks.
What does it mean that people can see so much violence and yet be aware of it but not feel compelled to change it?
Bell Hooks addressing the Texas Council on Family Violence in 1993.
People like you, people like those feminist activists who began the battered women's movement, have been truly successful in that we now have a culture
that fundamentally acknowledges the reality of violence against women. People really do acknowledge today, most people, that incest happens, that domestic battery happens. Even people who don't want to have anything positive to say about feminism will acknowledge these realities. The difficulty we face is, how do we move that acknowledgement past mere recognition into the willingness to do something every day of your life to change violence? And that is what I do not see. I have never forgiven Donahue, our, you know, talk show liberal male feminist, for that moment on his show when Scheherazade Ali was on there saying that sometimes black women need to be hit in the mouth. And there was Haki Madhubuti from Third World Press saying, indeed, I don't sell her books in my store because they condone violence against black women. And Donahue fixed that camera on him and he said, that's censorship. And my class and I have looked at that moment, and we've talked about how in that moment on national television, what Donahue actually did with his camera and with his symbolic power was to say, violence against women is not a real political issue. Now, censorship and free speech, that's a real political issue. Did many of you see the film Thelma and Louise? There is that moment in Thelma and Louise at the beginning that to me is so powerful, when the attempted rape has been interrupted. And I'm forgetting right now which one of them, Thelma or Louise, says to the violent, battering, abusive white male at that moment, when a woman is crying, she's not having a good time. And to me, that was one of those magical moments in cinema and in film, where I felt that anybody looking at that moment could click, it could click, like you could get it, like, wow. I suddenly realized that, in fact, when people are crying, often it signals perhaps that they're in pain, that they are sad, that something is wrong, that something is out of place. And I thought, this is the power of mass media, that it can make you feel for a moment something that can turn on that light bulb. But then I felt that what ultimately happened is the film then proceeded to undercut that moment throughout by making it seem like, well, guess what, world? Women are just as violent as men. Women are just as willing to humiliate men. Women will, you know, and I see this as a major theme running through how mass media is dealing with the issue of violence right now, saying things to us like, men may be violent, but women are so violent too. And if women only had the power men had, they would be just as violent. So I've been thinking a lot about the naturalization and the normalization of violence. What I think is happening in our culture is that people feel incredibly powerless to change it because they feel like it is normative. They feel like it is natural. I can't tell you how many people say to me that, don't you think the impulse to hit, or that's just a natural thing, and that's just how boys are going to be. And I think about all the incredible work we've done within feminist movement, within the movement of domestic violence, to try to undercut that, and the message has still not gotten across to people, that it is not normative, that it is not natural, the act of doing violence. I'm willing to even allow that the impulse can be talked about as a quote, natural impulse. I've been feeling very violent myself lately. And in fact, I've written a piece called Killing Rage, because I feel deeply enraged about the things that are not changing in this society. I had an experience recently that was the subject of this essay, and I want to talk about it here because I want to talk about how racism within and without the movement to end domestic violence continues to keep us apart. I got on an airplane with a black woman friend, and we were seated together in first class. We had those upgrades. And she had not been given a boarding pass. We were sitting in our little seats, and another black woman got on, and a white male was sitting in her seat and refused to move. The black woman was very nice. She said, that's okay, I'll sit anywhere. da-da-da-da-da. And I have to say that even other white, fellow white passengers asked this man to move. He was obstinate that he would not move. Then a white man got on who had a boarding pass for the seat that my friend was sitting in. He came to our sides and said, "You're sitting in my seat." And she said, "Oh, no, I was given this seat." And then a few minutes later, she was called to the front of the plane. I said to her, "Don't move." She didn't listen to me. She moved. She went up, and it was explained to her that she was in this gentleman's seat. And while the stewardess were neatly negotiating our body space, he went and sat in the seat with her purse, with her belongings. Everybody was looking at us on the plane. We were the difficult, angry black women who were up there discussing this. And it was very clear that nothing was going to happen. And I went back to my seat. And Mr. Smiling Liberal White Man, no doubt a feminist man in his imagination, says to me, you know, he says, "I'm so sorry. It's unfortunate, but, you know, I didn't really have anything, you know, to do with this." I said, "Don't tell me you're sorry. You watched her being humiliated. You watched them call her up to the front of this plane. And you didn't say there's no need for humiliation here. I'm willing to sit elsewhere." Or you didn't say, "I want my seat because I've been assigned to it, but I don't like what's taking place here. I don't condone what's taking place here." I said, "No, that seat was so important to you." And he had that little grin of, "I didn't let those, you know, wild black women, you know, get my seat." He had triumphed. And I felt rage towards him. And I'm going to be honest with you, if I could have killed him, I would have. And I don't say that lightly, and I don't say that. It didn't amuse me. I was scared that I felt that his refusal to see how racism and sexism work in this society and classism welled up in me so much that I felt murderous rage. And I'm telling you that everybody around me knew that I felt murderous rage because it was coming out of my pores. And I had never felt that in my life before. And it was one of those things where on one level it was trivial, but deep within me, it was like all those incidences of a failure to understand difference and solidarity and what it means. And I just began to weep intensely. Because I felt that why are we still having to deal with this? Why aren't people more aware? And I got out my pen and I began to write this essay that was called Killing Rage, Moving from Pain to Power. Because I feel that we have to hone our rage. We have to use it as a tool for vision and insight and understanding. This essay is a fine piece of work that came out of that rage. And I think that when we try to suppress our rage, it's when the dilemmas in our lives start. But one of the things that I've been thinking about, and I wanted to say, I also felt estranged from the black woman friend that I was with. I thought, why did she choose them over me? Why didn't she listen to me when I told her not to move from her seat? And I thought, why am I so angry at this injustice, and she seems to be more willing to conform? And at the end of the plane, I waited for her. And all these people came out, and all of a sudden I heard these voices screaming and yelling. And she came out, and she was in this intense battle with the stewardesses about racism and sexism. Because what had happened to her is when she went back to take the seat they said was hers, a white family was sitting there with their children. And do you know what they asked her? "Would you be willing to give up your seat so this family can sit together?" And she gave up her seat because she felt like she didn't really have any stake in the seat. But it enraged her that at no point was that white man asked, "Would he be willing to give up his seat so we could be together? Would he be willing to give up his seat so we wouldn't have to be humiliated publicly?" In fact, he was invested in our humiliation. And I know that many of you out there have had these same struggles around race on your jobs, with the projection onto black women and black people in general that we are too angry, that we want something for nothing, that we disrupt the harmony of gatherings with our critiques. People tell me all the time, I'm just so tired of hearing black people talk about racism. You know, and that right there makes me get angry. You tired of hearing people talk about racism? We are tired of experiencing racism. And we are tired of the ignorance about the connection between violence against women and the violence of racism and classism, because they converge. And I think that those of us who work around these issues see how they converge within us. I mean, look at the movement for domestic violence in this society. It has been a movement traditionally dominated by white women at the top and women of color as the victims, the people coming for services. That's how many people perceive of it. So what happens then when revolutionary, insightful women of color and black women come into such a movement and want to shake things up and want to deal with issues in a different way? We know what happens: confusion, anger, hostility, an end to discussion. I mean, the three words that I kept thinking about today in relation to talking to you was courage, challenge, commitment, forwards, and confrontation. Because I think that part of why we have not furthered our will to end violence in this society is we are afraid of confrontation. We are afraid of the violent feelings we have in ourselves towards one another within this movement. I said this morning to a group of black women I was talking to, I believe that white women have tremendous feelings of violence towards black women. The sense that black women need to be silenced, that we're too uppity, that we need to be closed down in some way. I see that same spirit of violence in black men often. Close these black women down, shut them up. They're getting out of order. They're trying to take over. I said to my sisters this morning, how many times do I go to give a talk where a white woman says to me, there's a black woman in my office and she's just so angry. She's, you know, we really want to work with her, but she's just so difficult. And this happens again and again and again. And I think, my God, haven't white women read our literature? Don't they understand the roots of this anger? You know, we used to think, and I think this is one of the things that's plaguing feminist movement and the movement to end domestic violence. We used to think that if you just put the knowledge in front of people, people would change. And what we find is knowledge does not in and of itself change people. People are altered through practice, through experiences, because you can have all the knowledge of something up here in your head. I can't tell you how many white women I encounter daily who have knowledge, book knowledge of racism, but who don't understand how they manipulate in meetings or what have you, with silence, with smiles. You know, people, my students used to say, always say that if black women are talking rapidly, loud, aggressively, they see that as negative action. But if a white woman is talking a lot and she's smiling and she's quiet, they don't see her as potentially occupying space, asserting power, because we think of power differently. Last night we had a deep discussion, Joe, Sheila, Judy, and I, about the question of differences and commonalities. And I couldn't sleep because I was thinking about this discussion, because it does seem to me that women all over the world share commonalities in our suffering. That when we suffer at the hands of patriarchy, at the hands of male violence, there is nothing unique and special about the form and nature that our suffering takes. It is common. The problem becomes the reality of that shared suffering does not mediate the differences, the different ways we understand that pain. A black woman who may be battered by a black man but who feels that she can't call a white police structure. That may be very different from a white woman who feels like, well, you've got to call that structure, who doesn't understand that moment of hesitation, that reflection about what it means. You know, the commonality that black men and black women share. We share commonly the suffering to end racism. And yet, I talk to black men daily who say to me, they go on and on about white supremacy, and I say to them, but what about the issues confronting black women? And they'll say to me, well, black women are in cahoots with white men. And suddenly, there's a gendered reading of the experience of racism which says black men suffer more. And somehow black women are getting away with a lot. And I think this is so sad given the reality of our experience. Why can't they recognize the different ways black women suffer? I hear black men and black people tell me all the time, well, you know, black men, if black men are violent towards black women and children, it's because the man is on them, because white supremacy is just hurting them so much. And I said, I don't buy that. White supremacy is hurting black women every day of our lives. But many of us do not go home and shoot and kill and maim and mutilate and beat. So what does that mean? You know, I have had to look back at my mother, who worked as a maid for white people. And when she came home from her little jobs, she used to be so bubbly and full of joy. And as a child, I had no idea that there might have been some violence to her spirit and herself and her humanity on that job. It never occurred to me to think about white female violent assaults on the personhood of black women, because the way she came home never suggested that I've just been denigrated. I've just been told to eat my little sandwich in the kitchen after I have prepared an elegant meal for the white family. She never conveyed any sense of what was done to her in that setting that might have made it extra hard for her to come home and be bubbly and share her little treats and give us that sense that all was right with our world. And what that says to me is that there is something within us that can handle our impulses to be violent, that can transform that rage into a generosity of spirit, love, and care. And if black women are capable of making that leap, then black men must be capable of making that same leap. And we must not buy into any structure that tells us that somehow black male violence against women is justified because of the pain black men experience at the hand of white racism. One of the things that we stayed up late into the night debating was the question of female violence against children. We were in disagreement about the enormity and the intensity of that and whether it was akin to male violence against women and children. Those of you who know my work, who've read my chapter on violence in feminist theory from margin to center, know that I am of that school that believes that part of the problem we have in ending violence is that so many women believe that violence is an acceptable means of social control. Even if they don't believe it is acceptable in their personal lives, they may feel that it's acceptable in the world beyond their lives. They may see young people like those young black females we saw on Donahue who would kill people. And the white women in that audience had no trouble standing up saying they should be locked away forever, that their lives should be taken away, that they should be punished beyond all belief. That's an endorsement of violence. But it's the notion of the acceptable violence, the violence that makes us safe, that makes us feel good. Part of what I feel we have to confront is how can we enable people to see the interlocking nature of violence? So many white women and other groups of women can be against the violence of sexism, but have no trouble with the violence of racism, have no trouble actively assaulting other people of color, verbal assault, when it's in their interest to do so.
On Wings, excerpts from Bell Hooks' keynote address to the Texas Council on Family Violence in 1993. She went on to deconstruct a current sitcom that normalized rejection of black women and transvestites, and a recent film that created entertainment from the slaughter of a black gay man and a Korean couple.
I live on a corner that has a Korean grocer. I had never witnessed any kind of negative encounter between black youth and those store owners. But once that film came into being, every time I went in, It's not so much that people look at violence and think that it's not wrong. They may look at it and think that it's wrong, but it's so exciting. It's so pleasurable. It's more intense and more fulfilling than any kind of effort towards nonviolence could ever be. I think that this is a deep and profound moment. How do we intervene on that seduction of violence? I had to ask myself, I watch a lot of films. Would I 10 years ago have wanted to kill that white man on the plane? Or would I have believed that with my Christianity of that time, with everything, I could convert him? Why was my immediate impulse so deeply violent? And I think it has to do with the intimacy of violence in all our lives, the normative nature of it, the way it creeps up in all our interactions. I want to close by saying that I thought a lot about why have we been so afraid of facing that violence within ourselves that comes up. Black female hatred and anger towards white women, the violence that comes up in these meetings. The violence when you just feel like, I wish I could go over and slap her, I wish I could pull her hair, I wish I could make her understand. Is that violence so radically different from the violence a batterer feels? I was talking on the phone and I found that this boyfriend of mine that I'm breaking up with had told me another lie, and I kept thinking, I wish I could beat him to death with this telephone. I wish I could just start pounding on him with this telephone so I could make him understand that this is serious. You know, I talked to my sister the other day, and her child had done something that was deeply upsetting, lied, disobeyed, gone out, left the door open, all of these things that potentially placed her in danger as a young woman in a large urban city in a poor neighborhood. And I said, well, what did you do? She said, I beat her. I had to beat her. I had to make her understand. And I said to her, but do you remember when Mama used to beat us to make us understand? And did we understand? Did the light go off? Did the magic happen for us that I've been beaten and I understand? You know? But what saddened me was I felt that she, and when we talked about it, the enormity of her feeling of powerlessness. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do to make her understand the seriousness of this situation, that she could have been raped, that she could have been battered, that the other children whom she left in the house with the door open could have been hurt. I didn't know how to make her understand the seriousness of that. So that I think that we are so bombarded right now with that tragic dimension, that tragic feeling of powerlessness. And it's interesting because she said to me that, you know, I'm going to find a therapist for her. And I said to her, but you know, you may have to find a therapist for yourself, to find out what is a more productive way I can intervene on this situation. I mean, this is a woman who has honed her feminist insights, a working class woman in America who has grown, who has broken out of the sexism in her domestic household, who has resisted. And yet, when faced with a situation of crisis, she falls back on those things that we always learn were the way to handle something and to make people understand. I think feminism has failed.